Well, church family, I probably need to share with you something, and it's not the most engaging of information, but I have to kind of go into like some church theory in America and North America. You realize that there's something that we call the 80% rule, and the 80% rule says that if you reach 80% of your capacity as a church building, that you will not grow anymore. Yeah, you'll go above the 80% for a little while, and then as soon as you do that, the next Sunday, it's gone, because in North America, in America, we like our personal space, we have good hygiene, but it's not so good that you want to sit like right next to each other on everyone's lap, and so typically in American, not typically, all the time, every American church, almost every culture in America, if your church building reaches that over 80% capacity, the next Sunday it goes back down below 80% because Americans and Christians, we're just enough and we're done. We can't handle it. Well, the reality is that we are at that point at this church. We have what happens if you've been looking at any of our attendance is we will have a big Sunday, and I'm telling, you know, all the elders and their wives, sit up front. Thanks. If you're an elder or a wife not sitting up front, how could you? And because we're running out of space and we don't have any space anymore, and but then after that first time, it goes down, and then we'll build back up and we'll go back down. And we've had a number of Sundays like that where we've got like 100 people here, and then the next Sunday it's right back down because we've outgrown capacity. And so because of that, back in June, I told the elders, this is it. We are, you know, we're looking at this. The 80% rule is hard and fast in America. You try and play, no, our church would be different. Nope. Our church isn't any different. If we have a super full Sunday next week, the week after that, we will be super empty again. It happens every single time. And it's frustrating as a pastor to see that happen. And so, you know, I'm looking at this whole situation. I have all this head knowledge from seminary, and I finally went to the elders and said, okay, we have to go to two services. We're doing two services, two Sunday morning services. We'll do them back to back. We have to do it. We have to. Otherwise, we will never grow anymore. Because let me be frank with you. I don't want the Orchard Church to be a failure. I want to see us succeed. Don't you want to succeed in your own personal life and in your own personal jobs or careers? Of course you do. How many of you want to be a loser? Right? Nobody. My younger brother used to go, and he'd tell his guidance counselors, they'd be like, what do you want to be when you get out of high school and everything? He'd say, I want to be a hobo. They'd be like, well, you don't want to be a loser. He's like, I didn't say I want to be a loser. I want to be a hobo. I'm going to be the best hobo out there. Right? So not even him saying, I want to be a hobo who rides the rails. And that's my home. Not even him. Yeah, he's an engineer now. But nobody really wants to be a loser. We all want to succeed. So we try to figure out what's the best way we can succeed in life. How can we believers be successful? How can you be successful? We all want to know. Nobody wants to be a loser. You might not want money, power, and fame, but you don't want to be a loser. We all want to find success in our part of the world. How can we be successful? King David, as you recall, since probably about 14 years old, he's anointed king over Israel, spent most of his time on the run from the mad King Saul, who God had rejected, but was still had all the positional power of king and would chase David down. David, finally, after a civil war, after many trials and tribulations, he comes to his official inauguration. All of Israel at this point has said, yeah, you're the king. But this next scene is his official inauguration. Read with me in 2 Samuel chapter 5, starting in verse 1. It says, all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, here we are, your own flesh and blood. Even while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led us out to battle and brought us back. The Lord also said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will be ruler over Israel. So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron. King David made a covenant with them at Hebron in the Lord's presence, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began his reign. So just so you guys know, 30. I'm 35. I'm not too young. 30 years old, running a whole kingdom. Stop saying I'm too young. I'm 5 years older than him. But you're no David. Yeah, okay, whatever. Verse 4, David was 30 years old when he began his reign. He reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all of Israel and Judah. So this is amazing, right? This is you go out, if you're in high school, and you try out for the team, and they accept you, and you're on the team. This is when you go for the job interview, for the job that you really want, and they give you the job. This is graduating from college. This is the moment you go and ask that person out on a date, and they say yes, as opposed to all the other ones who've rejected you for your whole entire life. This is an amazing moment. Finally, everyone's acknowledging, yes, David, you are going to be king. Wow, great stuff. Now, unfortunately, you know, when you get accepted onto the basketball team, which if that's ever happened to you, please let me know about that experience, because I've never experienced anything ever close to that success. But if it's you, like if you get accepted onto the basketball team, you don't just sit down and say, I'm done, right? Now you got to prove yourself. Now there's things to do, right? So that's what David does. Verse 6, the king and his men marched to Jerusalem against the Jebusites who inhabited the land. Now, they have never gotten rid of these Jebusites who are up in the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a high city. It is well guarded. You got the high ground. So if anyone starts coming at you, what do? You can take your bows and arrow. You don't even need a bow and arrow. Just take a rock. You know, it's just so well guarded that no one can get in. So these Jebusites have lived in this area, on this wonderful, well-fortified city for a long time. So the king and his men marched to Jerusalem against the Jebusites who inhabited the land. The Jebusites said to David, "You will never get in here. Even the blind and lame can repel you," thinking David can't get in here. All right. Right, we'll just throw a rock down. We'll have our children repel you. Verse 7, yet David did capture the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. He said that day, whoever attacks the Jebusites must go through the water shaft to reach the lame and the blind who are despised by David. For this reason, it is said, the blind and the lame will never enter the house. David took up residence in the stronghold, which he named the City of David. He built it up all the way around the supporting terraces inward. There's this saying, like they said, oh, the blind and the lame could repel you. So David takes them and he says, ha ha, I've defeated your blind and lame. So there was colloquial sayings and idioms that were brought up, and I have no clue what they really mean, but they used them whenever the writer of 2 Samuel wrote this down. So that's why he's saying, that's why people say this weird thing, because this is the origin of this word. But David goes, and he's got to prove himself, so he's like, okay, that's the most fortified area. That should be the capital city. He goes, and he marches up, and he gets the capital city. Yay! Score, right? He's made it. This is an amazing, successful moment in his life, in his career. He's done what no one else in the history of Israel so far could do, and he moves the capital up to Israel. This is, any of you guys golf? Anyone golf? Anyone? Yeah, a few of you. Do you ever go out golfing with someone, or maybe bowling? Anyone bowl? All right, this happens in that one too. I every so often hear stories where someone, you know, they got someone's going out, they're like, oh, I've never golfed before in my life. What's a bowling ball? Is this thing it? And you're like, no, that's a pin, and please come down from the end of the alley. You come this way. Right? Please don't use the putter to try, and you're never going to go anywhere if you use the putter to go all the way there. It's your first stroke, man. You can't use the putter. Please. Get a better club. So it's like a total beginner. They go out, and somehow they clean the floor with everyone, right? And they're just so obnoxious, and they're like, well, I've never even done this before. Whoa, I knocked all the pins down. Is that good? Yeah. I did it again. Is that good? Yeah. Right? Meanwhile, you've been over here, and you've been doing this your whole time, and you're like, beginner's luck. It's so obnoxious, isn't it? Right? Always. It's always the case. Because then they start overthinking it the second game, and then they lose terribly. But that's kind of what David's doing. You know, he just goes up. There's no plan that he has. He goes, okay, that's going to be my new plan. And he takes the thing. These Jebusites have been squatting on the promised land for generations. And David's like, okay, that's what we're going to do. And he goes and does it. It's amazing. It's like, just maybe the key to success is that old saying, the world belongs to the bold. Maybe you should just have reckless abandon and just do things and act right now without thinking about it. Maybe that's the secret to success. Maybe not. Verse 10, David became more and more powerful, and the Lord God of armies was with him.
King Hiram of Tyre sent envoys to David. He also sent cedar logs, carpenters, and stonemasons, and they built a palace for David. Then David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel and had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel.
Okay, so David, he didn't go to God and say, God, should I attack the Jebusites? He's like, let's go do it. Let's see what happens. And he wins. But all of a sudden, he realizes that he didn't win because he's awesome or his own ability. He won because God was with him. He won because God went before him. And how does God prove that? The king of Tyre comes and he sends like all these workers to build him a palace. He didn't even ask for it. All of a sudden, he's king, he's in Jerusalem, and they're probably living in tents, and they're like, all right, well, let's fortify the walls first. So he's fortifying the walls. The next thing he knows, this whole like building construction crew rolls in with all of these wood, the wood and the timber and the ability and stone and the mason workers. And they're like, yeah, we're here to build you a palace. Where would you like it? On a side note, nothing to do with the text, I am praying this week that someone rolls in like that and says, hey, we're going to build you a brand new big sanctuary. Where would you like it on the property? And then we'll build some classroom spaces and stuff like that. Like, that's what happened. Could you imagine if, you know, we're just here one day, and like this whole crew rolls in and hey, we're building you a new church. Why? Where do you want it? Yeah, anywhere. Pick a place. That's what happened. What kind of has happened here with David, though, is he does this thing, and he's successful. He probably thinks it's his own self because he makes a little poem about it. I've defeated you, blind and lame. You're the lame one now, I think would be the modern translation of it. He beats them, and then all of a sudden, all this stuff starts happening, and he realizes that God is really with him. This is kind of like when a young person goes out on their own for the very first time, and they realize, wait a minute, mom and dad really did a lot for me, right? You've all seen that thing on the internet that says, teenagers, move out of the house and get a job on your own now while you know everything, right? Right? You don't realize, I didn't realize it. I was generally a good kid. And when I moved out on my own for the first time, all of a sudden you realize, wow, how much mom and dad paid for, how much, you know, what they really did for me when you're on your own, all things being equal. You don't realize it. This is kind of David. All of a sudden he's like, oh, wow, God, you defeated those people for me. Wow, I see what you're doing. But unlike with parents, where the children move out and start to live on their own and separate, with God it's different. You never lose dependency on God. He's always there. You always need him. So David, realizing that God is with him and is blessing whatever David's deciding to do, does this in verse 13. After he arrived from Hebron, David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem, and more sons and daughters were born to him. These are the names of those born to him in Jerusalem: Shamul, Shabab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Nepheg, and the rest. If you've been paying attention to the text on your own, he was up to this point, seven wives and concubines, and as we pointed out before, And as we pointed out before, polygamy is never okay in the Bible. In Genesis 1 and 2, God establishes marriage between one man and one woman. That is God's design. You see quickly in Genesis 4 and 5, humanity very quickly perverted God's design for marriage, and people were starting to fall in polygamy. But every time you see polygamy in the Bible, God's never like, hey, high five, we're good, everything's good here. He never does that. Every time you see polygamy portrayed, what you see is problems every single time. It's either said explicitly or implicitly. And kings in particular were told in Deuteronomy, do not become like your neighbors and have multiple wives and multiply your wives. So David had seven up to this point, and then I feel like the writer of 2 Samuel did kind of like the theme song to Gilligan's Island, and they're like, we don't have time to go through all these additional wives or additional cast members, so they're like, and the rest here on Gilligan's Island. Right, right? There are some people who they don't get their names mentioned. So the writer says, David took more concubines and wives, and by the way, concubines were like kind of second-class wives.
from Jerusalem. And he lists out some of the names of the children born to him in Jerusalem. He mentions Solomon, even though at this point in the historical narrative, Solomon's not around, but they're just giving us a glimpse of what happens in the future. So he takes more wives. Never a good thing. Do you see what David did? He's like, wow, God is with me. Wow, he's blessing whatever I do. What do I want to do now? There's an attractive woman. There's another one. Oh, by golly, they're everywhere. And so he continues to marry women. Never a good thing in the Bible. One of my friends, Justin Lomaster, who is a writer I've produced on the Untold podcast, he wanted to say this quote originated with his dad, but he's not sure where exactly it came from. But he told me this the other day. Go ahead and put this up here. Definition of polygamy, having more than one wife. Penalty for polygamy, see definition. It never works out. It doesn't. David is sowing the seeds of his own destruction, as we'll see in weeks to come as we go through 2 Samuel. It doesn't work. But David realized God was with him and decided to do whatever he felt like doing because maybe God will bless him. Okay. Things were good, right? How many times do you just kind of, yeah, hey, God's blessing me. Things are going good. I'm just going to continue to roll out and do whatever I'm going to do. That's me. But then this happens. Something terrifies David. Verse 17. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they all went in search of David. But he heard about it and went down to the stronghold. So the Philistines came and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. So the Philistines, and you got to remember, these guys, David for a time was a mercenary in the Philistine army, right? Until, you know, he got kicked out, left, depends on who tells the story, but he leaves, right? This is the army that just beat Israel's army several chapters before. This is the army that had destroyed Saul's family. And why Saul was so terrified that he took his own life. This is the army that decimated Israel. No one has been able to defeat them until this time. They've just gone back to their own territory, and now they hear, oh, wait, wow, whoa, David's king. They have a king, and he's unified all of Israel. We're going to hunt him down, and we're going to kill him. That's what we're going to do, because we're so big and huge. And David, he's terrified. He goes to a stronghold in Jerusalem. So he goes into hiding, because he's scared, and he should be. Because the Philistines are all larger, and they have more technological weapons than them. Their weapons of war are more advanced. Israel is the underdogs. David goes into hiding. You know what this is like? Something absolutely terrifies you. You get a letter in the IRS from the IRS in the mail that tells you you owe more taxes than you could ever possibly imagine paying back. Right? You get news from a doctor about a medical condition. You have to deal with a landlord who is an immoral person and doing immoral things, and they're probably illegal, but you've got to hire a lawyer who you don't have money for in order to get out of the situation. You're in school, and you're overwhelmed with the demands that you have to learn this knowledge, and there is no way you can learn it. You just can't. David is terrified. He cannot fight these people. And he knows it. What do you do when you're terrified? After crying. What does David do? David does what we do all the time when we're terrified, when we're scared, when we're in way over our head. What does he do? He does what we all know we should do on a regular basis. Verse 19, then David inquired of the Lord. He ran to God. I'm in way over my head. I need your help. Verse 19, should I attack the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me? And the Lord replied to David, attack, for I will certainly hand the Philistines over to you. So David went to Baal Perazim and defeated them there and said, like a bursting flood, the Lord has burst out against my enemy before me. Therefore he named the place, the Lord bursts out. Name your church after that, by the way, if you're going to do a church plant. The first the Lord bursts out church of Kingsley. David did it. Verse 21, the Philistines abandoned their idols there, and David and his men carried them off. I love that because this harkens back to all the way back to 1 Samuel 4, where Israel got defeated and the Philistines carried off the ark. Now Israel, they've defeated the Philistines so huge that they leave what they think is their gods behind, right? So they run away. They run away, and Israel's like, woohoo, we got your stupid gods, right? It's like a frat prank or something. But they take them away because they're like, no, Yahweh is stronger than your false gods. So this is good. David turned to God, and God answered. He turned to the tax advisor, and the tax advisor said, okay, let's handle this. And all of a sudden, he's like, oh, wow, there's an answer. He turned to a higher authority. The higher authority comforted him and gave him a direction and gave him strength and gave him victory. That's how he found success. He turned to God. Okay, good. End of story, right? No. Verse 22, the Philistines came up again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. Now, text doesn't say this, but you'd have to guess. He so decimated them before that they left what they thought was their gods behind, right? Like, you don't leave your gods behind, right? Like, if you get scared or something, you don't go, oh, I'm going to leave my children behind, right? Like, you don't run away without the valuables, right? So he so utterly defeated them that they left what they thought were their gods behind, right? The most important thing that they had. And you'd bring the gods out because you'd say, they will give us victory, right? It's like their weapon of mass destruction. And they left it behind, right? So when the Philistines come back, do you think it was just the people that they had beaten before and they said, well, we'll try again, guys. If at first you don't succeed, try again, right? Do you think that's what happened? No. There's a bigger army. They're massive. They're huge. They fill the valley. They come back. They went and got their bigger brothers, right? We know that there's giants among the Philistines. Maybe they got some of them. So it's filling up and everything. Now, if you're David, you've just had this awesome success. If I were David, what would I do? I would say, you know what? I've had a victory before. I know how to take care of these Philistines now. I'm just going to go and beat them up, right? Absolutely. Yeah, when you start a new school, students, you're scared. So you pray to God and say, hey, God, give me help. I'm scared. I'm terrified, right? When you go to a new church. Going to a new church is terrifying. You get scared, and so you pray, God, help me. How do I go to this church? When you are starting a new job, the first day on the way in, if you're a follower of Christ, what are you doing? You're praying, right? You're asking God, God, I'm scared. Help me out here. Give me strength. Give me power. But do you do that on the second day of school, the second day of work? You do it on the third day, the fourth day. What happens after you've been doing the same job or going to the same school for 5 months? Right? Are you still terrified of going into those hallways, talking with those people? No. You're like, ha! Easiest thing in the world. I got this. I know how to do this. Right? You don't go and ask God for help because I know how to handle this. How can we be successful? David's already wiped the floor with the Jebusites, now the Philistines. And I think the surprise is verse 23. So David inquired of the Lord and answered, and he answered. So David goes back to God. God, instead of saying, oh, I know how to take care of this. I was scared before, but we beat him so much that one time. I'm going to go get him again. No. He stops and he waits and he goes back to God. And God says to him, verse 23, do not attack directly, but circle around behind them and come at them opposite the balsam trees. When you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, act decisively, for then the Lord will have gone before you and strike down the army of the Philistines. So David did exactly as the Lord commanded him, and the Lord struck down the Philistines and all the way from Geba to Gezer. So it's amazing, because I don't know about you, but when I'm confident in my own abilities, I don't pray. Someone says, hey, pastor, can you take out that load of garbage? I'm like, sure, I know exactly how to take out of that load of garbage. I'm not praying for that. That's ridiculous. Hey, can you tie your shoe? Sure, I can tie my shoe. I don't need to pray about that. Hey, can you go and preach a message? Sure, I can preach a message. I know how to preach lots of messages. I do it all the time, right? When I'm confident in my own abilities, I'm not scared, so I'm not going to God.
The amazing thing here is David, in a moment of incredible clarity, instead of saying,
I know how to beat those Philistines, they're a dime a dozen. I beat one of their giants one time, single-handedly, as a boy who's half naked. Ha, 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 ha. Which is what all of us do.
Instead, he took the time and said to God, probably through a prophet, and said, what do I do? And God said, no, don't go out. Circle. God gave him strategies. No, your imagination's not working correctly. God said, my ideas are better than yours. Circle around, back them, and you'll hear me marching in the balsam trees. So you'll hear like footsteps. I don't know if that's the wind going through them, but he says, you're going to hear the footsteps. That means I'm marching out, and then you go and march out with your army, and you'll wipe the floor with them. Okay. And God did. And God blessed him. How can we be successful? We can be successful by going to God and asking for wisdom, by looking to God for wisdom, by asking the Lord Jesus Christ for wisdom in every moment of our lives, in every decision we have to make. That's how we find success. It's not success defined the way the world defines it, by money, power, and fame, by winning the game. Success the way God and the Bible define it are more about taking on the character of Christ, by doing the sorts of things that Jesus would do, not the things that we would do, so that even if we fail at whatever task we're trying to do, if we've done it in the name of Jesus, we've done it in the character of Jesus, by loving God and loving others, and by being above board, then that's still success, even though you failed. We can be successful by asking God for wisdom. I started off this service by telling you, I told the elders, we have to go to two services, and we had I sent out emails to the hospitality team, to the children's team, to the worship team, and to another team I can't think of right now, I apologize, that told them that, look, we are going to two services starting at this date. We have to do it. We will not grow anymore. We have to. We're out of capacity. I'm tired of seeing this accordion sort of thing with our numbers here where people are like, it's way too full. We're not coming back, right? And then I went on vacation. Right? That's a good time to go on vacation. Hey, is this a popular thing? I don't care. I'm going on vacation. Here we go. I went on vacation. And we were back in New York, and I was talking to my sister-in-law, who just started, they moved, and so they had to find a new church. And I said, well, how do you like your new church? She says, I love it. It's an amazing church. And I thought, I love it when people say that, right? Because usually I hear people come to the pastor, and they complain about their other church, because they figure I'll be like, yeah, they're terrible, right? I don't want to pile on. But she said, I love it. And I said, oh, why'd you love it? And she says, you know, all the other churches we went to, you know, they always have like multiple services. And so I'd have friends who went to the same church, but they went to a different service. She's like, you know what? What's nice about this church is we have one service and we are one family. And from about the third week that I've been here 6 years ago, I realized this church has always existed because this church sees themselves as a family. And in my rush, and in my intellectual knowledge to say, we have a problem with space, how can we call, what can we do? We're God's church, so he's obviously with us. We are going to go to two services, because that's our only option, because we don't have money to build on an addition right now. That is our only option, is to go to two services. And when my sister-in-law said that, I went, booger, I need to pray. So I prayed about it. And I realized, with that one word she said, family, is that we would... don't hear what I'm not saying. Going to two services is not evil. It's not an evil thing if another church does it. For us, for right now, it is the wrong thing, because we would be taking the church family and dividing them in two. And I don't know about you, but if you divided a family into two households, that's not success. That's failure. And so I came back to the elders and repented and then told everybody else, false alarm, I was wrong. I hadn't gone and asked God. I just assumed this is what we need. And so I acted. I just assumed this is what we needed, so I acted. We can find success when we ask God for wisdom. Doesn't matter if it worked for the people down here. Doesn't matter if it worked for that godly person or this godly person. Maybe God's doing something different in your life. We ask God for wisdom. We saw David making some good decisions. We saw him making one really bad decision in this text. One of the places where I saw this illustrated was in, you can go put this picture here, is one of my favorite authors is Flannery O'Connor. Highly recommend her to you, not for the squeamish of heart, though. In one of her most famous stories, A Good Man is Hard to Find, it's a pretty boring story to start off with. It is about a family going on vacation. There is a grandma and her son and her daughter-in-law and two children. And the grandma, we've all known someone like this. She is generally an okay person, but she's very manipulative and very gossipy, and she like works very passive-aggressively to get people to do what she wants. And so she keeps doing this over and over and over again throughout the book, and you're like, why? Or the story, and you're like, why am I reading this? And eventually, her manipulations lead them to a place where their car gets broke down. And there is an escaped convict called the Misfit, who is a serial murderer, and he's escaped with his crew. The convict goes, and he systematically takes every member of the family out into the woods and kills them. And the grandmother is having a conversation with him, and she's a Christian, so she's quoting him about Jesus and everything. She has lots of head knowledge, but it's never penetrated her into her heart, and she doesn't act. And so finally, after everyone's been shot, it's just her and the Misfit. And the Misfit is questioning if Jesus even really did the miracles, and this woman, she even questions it now because it's never penetrated into her heart. I wasn't there, so I can't say he didn't, the Misfit said. I wish I had been there, he said, hitting the ground with his fist. It ain't right I wasn't there, because if I had been there, I would have known whether Jesus rose the dead or not. Listen, lady, he said in a high voice, if I had been there, I would have known, and I wouldn't be like I am now. His voice seemed about to crack, and the grandmother's head cleared for an instant. She saw the man's face twisted close to her own, as if he were going to cry, and she murmured, why, you're one of my babies. You're one of my own children. She reached out and touched him on the shoulder. The Misfit sprang back as if a snake had bitten him and shot her three times through the chest. Then he put his gun down on the ground and took off his glasses and began to clean them. Hiram and Bobby Lee returned from the woods, stood over the ditch, looking down at the grandmother, who half sat and half lay in a puddle of blood with her legs crossed under her like a child's, and her face smiled up at the cloudless sky. Without his glasses, the Misfit's eyes were red-rimmed and pale and defenseless-looking. Take her off and throw her where you've thrown the others, he said, picking up the cat that was rubbing itself against his leg. Huh, she was a talker, wasn't she? Bobby Lee said, sliding down the ditch with a yodel. She would have been a good woman, the Misfit said, if it had been someone there to shoot her every minute of her life. So here's this woman. She's manipulative. She changes, and all she wants is what's for herself. And finally, it takes this absolute, complete, utter moment of violence where she's terrified out of her mind, and she's even questioning Jesus. And finally, the text says, in a moment of instant clarity, she sees this clearly and says, "Why you?" She basically says, "I should have treated you like a son. I should have treated you like one of my own babies." And she reaches out with absolute compassion. No, nothing that she's going to gain out of it. It's just absolute, kind of the compassion that Jesus shows out to us. It scares him because he's never experienced it, and he shoots her. And these guys are like, wow, you know, she was a talker, right? And the murderer says she would have been a good woman if there had been someone there to shoot her every minute of her life. That is the story of King David. He was the greatest king when people were trying to chase him down and kill him, when Saul was trying to kill him. He was a phenomenal king. Why? Because he had to ask God for help every moment of the day. When the Philistines came out to attack him and he knew they were bigger, he knew they were stronger, he was the greatest king because he had to ask God for help, and God gave him wisdom and insight and power and strength. When wasn't he a good king? We even saw it in this text. We will see it in the weeks to come. But we saw it in this text. It's when he just said in verse 13, after he arrived from Hebron, David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem. He didn't ask God, go, hey God, who should I marry? And by the way, that's what we do oftentimes in our single life, isn't it? We say, when we're single, who should I date? Who do I want to date? Who do I want to marry? Wrong question if you're a Christian. You ask God, who should I date? Who should I marry? God might say no one right now. God might say be single and serve me. God might say, well, I don't know. I might give you options, but certainly not that knucklehead that you're with right now. We don't do that. We only ask God when we're in our moments of stress, when we're scared, when we're like, I can't handle this. I'm overwhelmed. And so like David, we're often a mixture of good and bad. And when we see God's on our side, we just act and we say, well, I'm going to add two services. Let's add three. Yeah, we'll add three. I'm so smart. And God's like, no, 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 that's not going to work. I don't want you to do that for this church right now. James 1:5 says this. Go ahead and put that up there, Drayton. Now, if any of you lack wisdom, you should ask God who gives all generously and without criticizing, and it will be given to him. How can you be successful? We're not successful by pulling ourselves up on our own bootstraps. We're not successful by being smarter and harder working than everyone else. No, we're Christians. We're followers of the living God. We are successful when we go to God and we ask him for help. Even in those moments, even in those times where we're like, I'm totally confident. That's probably when you need to ask him help for the most. Don't raise your hands. Seriously, don't raise your hands. It's a rhetorical question. How many of you prayed on the way to church this morning saying, God, what would you have me do at church? Don't raise your hands. Some of you did because you did, but how many? How many? Maybe God would say, hey, go and seek out people you don't know and have a conversation with them. He might say that. But no, I don't. I'm like, hey, it's cool. I know everybody here. It's fine. No. It's a simple task. In our lives, we just don't ask God for help. We don't ask him for wisdom. You can be successful. Not success the way the world defines it, but the way Christ defines it. Not success in the short term, because the world's success is always short term. Success in the long term. Success that changes the world. More than changes the world, it stretches into eternity. Because you love people the way Jesus loved them. You care for people the way Jesus cared for them. You stand for truth the way Jesus did and not the way the rest of the world wants you to. You stand for his word and you see people transformed. How can you be successful in all the areas of your life, in your job, in your family, in your relationships, in your homes? You can be successful by asking God for wisdom. Whatever you are doing, pray first. Pray first. Let's pray. Father, it is so hard for us when things are going well to ask you for your help. I know that I will fail each and every time. So, Lord, I pray for myself. I pray for this congregation. That God, the Holy Spirit, will do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And that in the name of Jesus, we will come and we will ask you for help. We will ask you for wisdom, trusting that you will give us that wisdom in all the decisions we have to make, even when things are going well, Lord. Help us to be like David and pray when we are scared and terrified. But help us to be like Jesus Christ, the author and perfecter of our faith, who as he walked this earth in perfection, even called out to you when things were going well in the midst of the height of his ministry. Help us, Lord, to seek wisdom from you in all things. It's in Jesus Christ's name that I thank you and pray.